For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We've been studying through the book of Acts, and we're all the way up to chapter 14 at this point, and the context is the first missionary journey. Luke, our author, chronicles several of these missionary journeys, which are these incredible adventures, really, missions where a band of Christians are sent out across the Roman world with the message about Jesus Christ. And that's really what they're doing, is proclaiming what we call the gospel or the good news. And so far, you know, as we've been following along in this first missionary journey, we've been following Paul and Barnabas. They made their way all the way to Pisidian Antioch. And last week we read Peter's speech, Paul's speech, where Paul was like, here is the good news about Jesus Christ. And he announced to them that each and every one of them could be made right with God because of Jesus' death on the cross. And what he got was this polarized response, where some people responded to that right away. Other people, we read, repudiated that message. They pushed it away. And kind of dramatically, he turned his attention to the Gentiles, to the non-Jews. And some of them were more receptive. So that's kind of where we left off. And they were eventually run out of town. They were run out of Pisidian Antioch, made their way to Iconium, and that's where we pick up here in chapter 14. It says, in Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together and spoke in such a manner that a large number of people believed, both of Jews and Greeks. So really, the story just repeats itself in Iconium. They go, they seek out the Jews, they proclaim the gospel to them. Some of them respond. Others reject it. There are also people who are not Jews. There are Greeks there, and some of them respond, and some of them reject it. It says, but the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. So we've got, you know, there's an opposition in the city. Therefore, it says, they spent a long time speaking boldly with reliance upon the Lord, who is testifying to the word of his grace, granting that signs and wonders be done by their hands. So they see that some people are responsive, so they stay, even though some people are against them, and they continue to preach the gospel. And it says that God was backing them up, authenticating what they were doing through signs and wonders. But the people of the city were divided, so that plays out again the same way. And some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe and the surrounding region. So they're pushed out of Pisidian Antioch, and then they're pushed out of Iconium, and they go down, it says, to Lystra and Derbe, which are cities which are nearby. And what do they do in Lystra and Derbe? They continue to preach the gospel. So there's a pattern here, okay? At Lystra, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, who had never walked. Lame from his mother's womb. That's not how we would word that today, okay? That's an idiom from their time. But it's important because it means that he had never walked. From the time he was born, the man has never walked. These were not giant cities. These were small towns. Everyone would have known this man. He would have, in their culture, he would have been a beggar, certainly. It says, this man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he had fixed his gaze on him and had seen that he had faith to be made well, said with a loud voice, stand up on your feet. And he leaped up and began to walk. So it's a miraculous healing. And there's a lot we could say about that. There have been a number of events like this, and we've already said a lot about them in Acts. The thing I want to point out about this is that there's an almost identical episode that happens in chapter 3 with Peter. The other person we've seen doing something just like this is Jesus. And so I think Luke is making a point here that the torch is being passed here to Paul, and that God is authenticating Paul's message just the same as he did Peter's, just the same as he did Jesus himself. It says, when the crowd saw what Peter had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lyconian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down to us." So that, you know, they see this happen. I mean, try to imagine for a minute. Someone you've known your whole life who's never walked, and a guy comes to town and is like, "Get up," and he walks. That would be completely mind-blowing. That would be mind-boggling. And they are boggled, okay? They see this and they jump to the only conclusion that could possibly make sense, which is that the gods themselves have come to earth. They're like, it's the gods. What I think is funny, I love this episode, because Luke points out that they say it in the Lyconian language. So there was Greek, which is the trade language. Everybody spoke Greek. But then localities still had their local language, their ancient language. And so they're saying this to each other in their regional language, which means that Paul and Barnabas would have no idea what they're saying. So they're like, it's the gods. You know, and Paul and Barnabas are like, yeah, it's nice to meet you. You know, I have no idea what they're saying. I had an experience, this reminded me of an experience I had years ago when we were visiting over in Cambodia. And there was this group of boys, you know, when you're tall and white, you stick out in Cambodia. And there was this group of boys who were clearly talking about me and my friends. They're sitting over here, they're smiling, they're pointing, and they're talking, and we have no idea what they're saying. And finally, this kind of brave kid comes up to me, and he walks up, and he reaches out, and he grabs my stomach like this. He grabs my stomach, and then he goes, he flexes. And he's like, "Oh, like, you're strong. Like, look how big your gut is. You must be a superhero." In Cambodian culture, it's cool not to be thin, all right? Which makes me, like, super cool. And so, you know, they're just like, "It's awesome." And I was kind of like, "Oh, yeah, okay, great. Feels honored." Well, anyway, it says, they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes because he was the chief speaker. They believed in the Greco-Roman pantheon of gods. They believed in hundreds of different gods. Different gods that specialized in different cities. They had patron gods. They had different, you know, you could worship the emperor as a god. That was totally cool in their culture. And so they're like, you know, Barnabas is Zeus and Paul is Hermes. These gods, they're not like Yahweh in the Bible. These are gods, these are lowercase g gods. Like, on the one hand, they're better than people. They're more powerful than your average human being. But they're also limited. You know, their gods made mistakes and lost their temper. Their gods could be fooled or tricked or do evil things. Their gods could die. And so they're kind of these overgrown humans. They're like Thor in the Avengers, you know, or like Maui in what's that movie? You know, Moana. Thank you. You guys got your Disney down. So they're like, yeah, Barnabas must be Zeus. Zeus was the ruler of the gods. He was the god of lightning and the sky. He had won that from his father. They had overthrown his father, and then he drew lots between his brothers Hades and Poseidon to see who would be the ruler. I'm not sure why Barnabas got to be Zeus, but Paul, they thought, was Hermes. Hermes was the god of travel. He also was the messenger of the gods. So some people think, since Paul was probably the chief speaker, that they're like, oh, that's Hermes. And so this is the conclusion that they draw about them. It says, the priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. Okay, are you getting this picture in your head here? This is total pandemonium in Lystra. There are crowds. There are garlands and wreaths. Here comes the priest of Zeus with oxen. I'm sure they're like, what is this? Why are they bringing oxen? To sacrifice them because Zeus and Hermes came to town today. Oxen are the big deal. They didn't bring out doves. They brought out the oxen, and they're going to sacrifice them to you right now. So what's going on here in this picture? Well, I think it's pretty easy to see what's going on. They have seen something that they cannot explain, and they have done their best to explain that given their paradigm of thinking. They interpret it according to what they know. It must certainly be the gods. And I think this makes sense, especially when you know some of the stories and legends that were popular about around this time about the gods. Like, for example, Ovid, who's one of the great Roman poets, he wrote a lot of stories and tales about the gods. Did you know that he wrote a story called Metamorphosis, which is about none other than Zeus and Hermes disguising themselves as travelers, showing up at people's homes to test them and see if the people will show them hospitality? And in the story, no one shows them hospitality, and they're turned away at 1,000 homes before they arrive at this penniless old couple who has nothing, but they virtuously take the travelers in, and poof, they reveal that it's actually Zeus and Hermes, and they reward them by transforming their home into a temple with a golden roof and pillars, and they flood the rest of the valley as a punishment. And the lesson is, better show hospitality to the gods. Do you know where Ovid set that story? That story is set in the Phrygian hillside. It's right in the vicinity of Lystra. This is a local tale. This is a local claim to fame. It's probably why they had a temple to Zeus. And so here come two travelers who do a miracle. And everyone's like, clearly, clearly, this is Zeus and Hermes. I think the point here is that taking the gospel to the Gentiles is going to have some challenges of its own. You know, all through Acts, there's been the challenge of the gospel clashing with the existing Jewish religious authority. And as we saw last week with some dramatic flair, they're like, behold, we're turning to the Gentiles because they're responsive. And they are, but there's different hurdles here. Totally, we've got a gap in understanding. Their whole concept of the divine is totally different. When you say God, you don't mean the same thing to them. Monotheism is an alien concept to these guys. So you can't come like we did last week. You can't come and pull out an Isaiah verse and expect that to bear any, you know, have any bearing at all. You can't make your argument from the Psalms. You can't be like, let's start with the Davidic covenant. You know, they're going to be like, Hermes, what are you talking about? You know, because it's a total miss because their foundation is completely different. And so they've done what I think most people do when they hear the gospel, which is that they understand it according to their current prevailing worldview. They have incorporated it into their worldview. Two guys show up and say, good news. And they're like, it is good news. It's Zeus and Hermes. They've misappropriated the good news. And the reason I'm making a point about this is I think that this is exactly what we do in our culture. We are Gentiles, most of us. We live in the far-flung parts of the earth just like them. And when the gospel comes to our ears, we tend to interpret it according to our prevailing worldview, which for most of us is not the Greco-Roman pantheon of gods. But we've got our own pantheon of ideas. We've got our own philosophies that are just kind of here in our culture, that were here before you were born. Big ideas. Things that are just like baked in the cake. Like, for example, materialism and naturalism. This is, and I'm not talking about like greed, like avarice. I'm talking about the philosophical idea that what's really real in the universe is matter. Matter is all that's real. And that explains everything. It's just stuff. It can all be explained in the lab. And there's no room for the supernatural. So if there's something I can't understand, it's just because we haven't understood matter well enough yet and how matter interacts with other matter. And that's the highest reality. I think that, if you're born in my generation, most of the friends that I grew up with, they hold to that or some version of that pretty closely. That, look, there's what's real in the universe and then the other stuff is hocus pocus. And so that's just kind of baked in the cake. If you grew up around here, then you didn't like ever choose or ascribe to that. It just kind of came with the territory. Or rationalism, which is just the philosophical idea that what's really at the top of reality is human understanding. It's what we can understand is what's real. Or how about relativism and postmodernism? Those are just the ideas that when you get, you know, you want to get down to what's really real, the basic worldview is that, well, it's all just kind of a matter of perspective. You know, reality looks different from your point of view than mine, and we all have different cultures and backgrounds. And so who's to really say what's ultimately real? Or if there, you know, how could you even know if there was an ultimate reality and there's really not any sort of concrete reality? It's just how you experience it. These are ideas that are just kind of swirling around in our culture. And so then when the gospel comes to us, we hear it on those terms. So, someone comes up to you and says, did you know Jesus died on the cross for your sins and was raised from the dead? And God is offering you forgiveness and eternal life if you turn to him in your heart. That's the gospel. We hear that and we're like, okay, some people believe that. There's, of course, no way to know if Jesus ever lived or died. Sins are an antiquated cultural concept that I don't happen to ascribe to, conveniently. And this poor naive person means well, but come on. Or we say, you know, it can't be, the gospel can't be objectively true because its claims are supernatural. But if you believe it, then it's real for you and that's real enough. A statement like that would go down real easy in the company that I keep. Friends in my neighborhood, they'd be like, yeah, I can agree with that statement right there. Spiritual beliefs are a matter of preference. It's like when we go to the mall and there's the food court and you go to Sbarro and I go to Charlie's and it's cool. And who's to say? Your faith is a lifestyle choice that works for you. I don't need to believe that, but if you need to believe that, then that's cool for you. If the gospel message resonates with you personally, then add it to your spiritual portfolio. It's supernatural, so who knows, and anything goes. But you know, if it adds to your life improvement project, if it helps you fill out your sense of identity and you need that, that's great. Because ultimately, faith means setting aside reason and knowledge to trust in something because it improves your life. And that's beautiful. Right? This is how our culture thinks about when they hear the gospel, this is what we think. Or like Mark Twain more cynically puts it, faith is believing in what you know ain't so. So what happens is the gospel comes to our ears and it comes through that grid. And so we either misunderstand or misappropriate the gospel. But here's the problem. The gospel doesn't fit into any one of those worldviews. The gospel isn't a rival human idea of a worldview. The gospel is proclaimed truth from on high with a capital T. It's not another idea for what's true. It's God's proclamation. He's like, well, let me tell you my worldview. And I'm God, so my worldview is the one that actually is, regardless of how you feel about that. So the gospel is bringing something completely different to the table, and so there is a clash then when we take it and interpret it on our own terms. We misunderstand it. So how do Paul and Barnabas respond? It says, but when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard it, they tore their robes, and they rushed out into the crowd, crying out. So someone comes up to them, you know, in Greek and was like, you get they think you're Zeus and Hermes, right? And they're like, what? No. And they tear their robes. That's what in Jewish culture, that's your sign of revulsion. You do that when you hear blasphemy. They tear their robes. They run out in the crowd. No, no, no. Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you. I'm not a god. I'm not Hermes. And why does he get to be Zeus? You know, they're like, they're trying desperately to correct the misunderstanding here. So they say, we're just like you, we're people, we're men, and we preach the gospel to you that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. our hope, we're not Zeus and Hermes. We're here to tell you, you should turn away from these things. And he calls them vain things. That's culturally insensitive. Paul did not get the memo that you're not supposed to diss people's sincerely held beliefs. He calls them vain things. What's it mean? The word vain is the word for futile. It means useless or no purpose. Vain is not like a sweeping value judgment. He's not saying, it's not a cultural evaluation. Your culture is lame. It's a truth evaluation. He's saying what you believe does not have any value, or it doesn't have any use. It isn't functionally valuable. So that word, vain, that's in the Old Testament, that word is often used to describe the idols, idol gods. So I take a block of wood and I carve it into a statue and I'm like, this is God. And God's like, no, that's a block of wood that you carved. It's a nice carving. I'm not down on your carving skills. It's a nice carving, but it's a lousy God because it can't do anything. It's vain. I realize it's brutal to say that someone's beliefs are futile or vain, but from the biblical point of view, if it's not true, it's vain. In the winter, on school nights, when it starts to snow, my kids turn their pajamas inside out and they flush an ice cube down the toilet in hopes of conjuring a snow day. That's what kids do now, if you didn't know. That's the thing now. Okay? Now, is that good or bad? Well, it's not good or it's fine. You know what I mean? It's not that it has no value. It has a certain value in that it's a fun tradition. But it is completely vain and futile when it comes to getting a snow day. It's not going to affect the weather. For sure. It's for sure vain. And so you could look at that and say, go ahead, that's cute, but it's futile. That's what he's saying. He's saying, you guys are believing in something that is futile because it's not. The problem with Zeus is that he's not there. That's not where lightning comes from. And I know that, and you know that. And Paul and Barnabas knew that, and they didn't. And he's saying, if your hope is in Zeus, if you think that sacrificing that ox is going to do something other than kill an ox, then you're wrong, and that's sad. And you should turn from that, he says. Slaughtering an ox to Zeus is vain or useless from a spiritual standpoint. He's just saying, guys, don't put your faith in something that isn't true. And by the way, the Bible holds itself to that standard. The Bible is utterly consistent on this point. Faith is not a beautiful thing that you choose to believe in. The idea of faith is that I'm putting my trust, hopefully, in something worthy of my trust. And then if you're putting your faith in something that is not worthy of your trust, that's a big mistake and a tragedy, and don't do that. In Corinth, the church there was beginning to say something about the resurrection. They were like, well, you know, maybe he didn't actually return from the dead. Maybe it's just a metaphor. Maybe he rose in your heart. We're not so sure he really rose from the dead. That's no big deal. It's still a faith that we have. And Paul jumps in and he's like, no. It totally matters whether he did or not. He says in chapter 15, and if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is vain. And your faith is also vain. Moreover, we are even found to be false witnesses of God because we testified against God that he raised Christ. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless and you're still in your sins. If this isn't real, then we are completely wasting our time this morning. You should go home and mow your lawn and watch the game because it's nice out. And none of us have time to be here believing in something that isn't actually true. And this is what he's saying to them. He's saying, turn from... I'm really glad no one actually got up. bad time to go to the bathroom. The point here is it's not about which message sounds better or has more appeal. It's about which message is actually true. And he's saying you guys should turn from what's not true and turn to a living God who is actually there. The opposite of believing in something vain is believing in the living God. That's the contrast that he's making. And then he throws a verse at them, which is kind of surprising. He throws a Bible verse. It's where he says, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. That's a great verse for them, though, because it's a description of God. He's introducing them to the Creator God, the God who made something. It's not like your gods. You know, they believe that their cities came from gods who began those cities. He's like, no. You worship the sky and the lightning. I am introducing you to the God who made the sky and the lightning. It's distinguishing vain versus living, many overgrown humanoid gods versus the one supreme creator God. This is the contrast. He's like, that is the God that I'm here to tell you about, something totally different. You see how he's laying a new foundation? He's like, start over, new worldview. There's one God who made everything. He says, in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. So that's a correction of their worldview too. It's not that different gods created different cities. It's that one God made everyone. Humans emanated from God and are in fact wayward and lost, and God's on a rescue effort to regather them together. He's giving them the whole new paradigm here. And yet it says he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. So I know that you've never heard of this God before, but he did not leave you without a witness. Maybe you've never read the Old Testament scriptures. Maybe you don't know about the prophecies that have been fulfilled. Maybe you never even heard about Jesus. But he has left a witness on the stand that even you can look and know him. And then it's cool because then Paul gives like this mini case for a creator. And it's exciting because this is a completely different approach to the gospel than we've seen all through the book of Acts. He's coming from a totally different angle. He's meeting them right where they're at, and he's saying, look around you at nature. What do you see? Says, and here's what he sums it up. He says he did not leave himself without witness, and that he did good and gave you rains from the heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. He just points to the mundane things around them in your heart, in your crops, in the heavens. There's evidence for a creator all around you. This is what theologians call general revelation. You can't know everything about God from looking around at nature, but you can know something about it. You can know that he's there. Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So he says, look at your, why does it rain down? Why do your crops grow? Why does the earth produce food for humans to live? Why do the seasons come in and out? It's almost as if this place has been designed to facilitate life, you know? And he's pointing to that fact. I think this is kind of a good exercise. When I was working on this, I went out for a walk, just on a trail I always walk on, and I was like, I'm going to try to notice details I don't ordinarily notice. I took a picture. Okay, it's just a tree. It's probably a weed. But you look at it, and you're like, man, you know what? That's beautiful. And it is beautiful, right? Now, if there's no God, if we're all just matter, then strictly speaking, that is not beautiful. What would beauty be? It's matter interacting with other matter, surviving in its environment, reproducing. And so am I, a giant bag of matter with a gut, interacting in a favorable environment for survival and finding that attractive. That is all it is. Now, can you accept that? Or deep down, do you know there's something else to it, that it's also beautiful? That's what the Bible says, that God created it, he made it, and it was good. It's more than just there. It's also good. This is his point. Look around you. This stuff isn't just there. It's there from something. And he's making this case from the everyday mundane things around them all the way up to the heavens and the earth. He's like, look at the sky. You know, they were fascinated in ancient times by the night sky. They did not understand it very well, but they understood there was an order to it. And that blew their mind. How is there an order to the night sky? Cicero, who was a Roman orator, he wrote like a couple decades before this. Listen to what he says about the night sky. He says, when we see something moved by machinery, like an orrery or a clock or many other such things, we do not doubt that these contrivances are the work of reason. Think about a clock, right? A clock did not randomly fall together. Clearly, it's been put together or designed. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, what is an orrery? Because that's what I was thinking. I read this and I was like, yeah, good point. What's an orrery? An orrery is one of those contraptions that shows how the solar system works with gears and stuff. Here's a Lego orrery, all right, that I found a picture of online. They didn't have ones this complex. They had much more primitive orreries. But he's saying, look at an orrery. There's a design to that, right? Play this philosophical game. Look at that Lego contraption there. Here's the question. Where did it come from? I haven't told you anything about it. I didn't build it. Wish I could. Where did it come from? Well, you look at that and you're like, well, clearly it was made, right? Someone put that together. You would be mad to look at that and say it was a happenstance, it was an accident. Even if you had an infinite amount of time, it would not chance together, right? So if we look at this and say, clearly this had to be made, how much more the actual universe in which we live than this silly reductionistic model of a tiny slice of it? That's his point. He says, when therefore we behold the whole compass of the heaven moving with revolutions of marvelous velocity and perfect regularity, how can we doubt that all this is affected not merely by reason, but by a reason that is transcendent and divine? You see not the deity, yet by the contemplation of his works you are led to acknowledge a God. He could see it. I think Cicero's argument holds up. I think it is many times stronger today than it was back then. The more that we learn about our environment around us, this argument just gains steam in my mind. Whether we're talking about the highest expanse, Psalm 19:1, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Whether we're talking about the farthest out thing we can see, this is what we call external evidence, the things around us that we can look at and see evidence for God. Like this is a Hubble image of the Pegasus dwarf galaxy. It's a neighboring galaxy. Every point of light on there is a star with planets around it. Like, try to take in the vastness of that for a minute. Do you know how many galaxies there are like that in the observable universe? 100 billion. And whether we're looking out at the stars or whether we're looking down at the tiniest microscopic subatomic thing we can see, what do we find? Complexity, order, beauty. And we always find it. What does that tell you? Even when we're talking about the origin of the universe, you know, you've heard of the Big Bang. One of the interesting things about the Big Bang is in order to get a bang that results in an expanding universe like the one we have, you have to have very specific conditions at the beginning. Think about all the mass and energy in the universe had to be all compacted in a very small space, perfectly fit together and completely evenly fit together. Otherwise, a Big Bang would have been lopsided, collapsed, would not have resulted in what we have. And the precision needed, you know how perfectly aligned all those atoms needed to be? A precision to the degree of one part in, I memorized this number, one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd. That's a one with 123 zeros. If you want to get your mind around that number, imagine that you could take an atom and put a one on it, and you had a bunch of atoms with ones on it. You still couldn't physically see that number because there are not enough atoms in the observable universe. You have to not be off by one of those to get the conditions necessary for the Big Bang. That's called low entropy. It's a high order state. I was listening to this, one of my favorite shows, the TED Radio Hour. They're interviewing a theoretical physicist from Caltech. He's describing that number and that state. Listen to what he says. It says, in the past, our universe was more dense, and it was also hotter. If you squeeze things together, the temperature goes up. That kind of makes sense to us. The thing that doesn't make sense to us as much is that the universe, at early times near the Big Bang, was also very, very smooth. That's the word he's describing that he's using to describe what I just was describing. At early times, those 100 billion galaxies were squeezed closer together. And you have to imagine doing that squeezing without any imperfections, without any little spots where there were a few more atoms than somewhere else, because if there had been, they would have collapsed under the gravitational pull into a huge black hole. Keeping the universe very, very smooth at early times is not easy. It's a delicate arrangement, and it's a clue that the early universe is not chosen randomly. There is something that made it that way, and we would like to know what. Now, this guy is not a Christian, okay? I heard that, and I sat up in my seat like, yeah, like, right. What made it that way? So the host says, well, if there was low entropy at the beginning, if there was order, could it suggest that there was something that intended it to be that way? That's the million-dollar question. Carol, it could be. If you ask a question like that, the answer is, yeah, it could be. There's many things that are possible. That's certainly something that people have thought about. There's something called the teleological argument, or the argument from design for the existence of a supernatural creator that says, you know, features of our universe, if they were very different, wouldn't have allowed for us human beings to exist. Now he's going to shoot it down. But the early universe, interestingly, the problem is not just that it was quite orderly, but that it was really way more orderly than it needed to be for us to be here. So if you really want to make this argument that the universe is set up to allow for the existence of life or humanity or something, the early universe is overkill. So it seems that whatever the explanation is for why the early universe has the features it does, that's not really a good one. We need something to explain why it is so exquisitely low entropy. So many particles in such a very, very specific state. And as physicists, we have theories. You know, we don't know which one is right. It's early times as far as this big kind of question goes. But it's not hard to imagine that we'll get a good physics explanation rather than reaching for something beyond the physical world. So what's he saying? He's like, nah, it couldn't be set up for humans because it's way too good for that. Way too good for that. I don't know what caused it, but I'm confident we'll get a physics explanation. The host pressed him, well, so what's your explanation? He says, maybe the Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe. An unbroken egg is a low entropy configuration, and yet when we open our refrigerator, we do not go, oh, how surprising to find this low entropy configuration in our refrigerator. That's because an egg is not a closed system. It comes out of a chicken. Maybe the universe comes out of a universal chicken. Now, that sounds ridiculous, But that is actually the leading theory out there, that there is something beyond our horizon that we can't see that spits out universes ready for the Big Bang, that spits out super highly organized, low entropy balls of matter, which I'm guessing would also be a highly organized process. And it doesn't really satisfy the question, does it? Because then the next question is, well, where did the chicken come from? Right? You have to get back to an uncaused cause. What's he really saying here? Not to bash this guy, but like, think about his logic. He's saying, I know there is something behind the universe. I know it's there and that it's astonishingly complex and incomprehensible in its perfection. I know that I don't know anything about it, but I know that it's not God. And I'm confident physics will someday explain it. Man, that's faith. Right? What takes more faith to believe in? A God with plenty of evidence for him, or a universe chicken with the attributes of God? You know, I'm listening to this guy and I'm like, dude, why don't you just cut to the chase and call it God? That's what you're describing. I think it exposes one of the big holes. The problem with those worldviews I put up earlier that we have, they have giant holes in them. And the big problem with materialism is that matter cannot account for matter. Where does matter come from? Why is there anything at all? Matter cannot answer that question. That's external evidence. When we look inward, we see the same thing. If I just introspect for a minute about the things that you know are true in your heart, those are pretty hard to account for without a creator too, like the fact that I'm a person, that there is such a thing as Ben Faust beyond just material. Well, how can you account for that if there's no creator? What about the idea that I'm making a choice? You know, if you're going to be consistent from a materialistic or naturalistic worldview, then you have to deny choice. It might seem like you're making a choice, but you're actually just a super complicated machine responding to stimuli in a predictable way. You're not choosing anything. Or morality. Do you believe that there's such a thing as right and wrong? You can't account for that outside of a supernatural being. That people have value in equality. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That is a value we still hold dearly to this day, that people have an inherent value to them. But that doesn't hold in a naturalistic worldview at all. If we're just matter, in what sense are we equal? We're not equal. No, if you believe that there's an equality among people, then you have borrowed that from monotheism. You've borrowed that. That's a holdover from Judeo-Christian thought. Purpose and significance. That anything I do matters beyond my existence. How do you account for any of these things outside of a creator? If you want to deny a creator, the only options... You either have to embrace the super uncomfortable implications of believing that we're all just matter. You have to look upon your kids and say they are just stuff. Or you have to just live inconsistent with your beliefs. Or just never think about it, which is what most people do. Listening to an interview with an atheist who's famous for saying choice is an illusion, no one really chooses anything. And the guy pressed him like, well, doesn't that bother you? Isn't that hard to live out? And he says, to be honest, I can't really accept it myself. I can't really live with this fact from day to day. Can you really? He's saying, I know it's right, but I can't bring myself to live it out. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, well, what does that say about it as a worldview? If I can't even live it out for a day, is that really an accurate roadmap to reality? If I can't even live with the implications. Well, the worldview that Paul proclaimed to them that day doesn't have any of these problems. No problem accounting for the qualities I see around me and the qualities that I see within me. We possess these qualities because our Maker possesses these qualities. You're made in the image of God. That's why you're a person. That's why you matter. That's why you have a purpose. That's why you're able to choose. That's why there's such a thing as right and wrong. One philosopher said, because I am a someone and not a something, the source of human life must be a someone and not a something. Can something personal come from something impersonal? Could that happen? Could an impersonal force generate a personal being? Could a non-moral reality create something moral? No. No. No, you're the way you are because the one who made you is that way. When I was a kid, I used to play Legos, and I would get them all out and build stuff. No orreries, sadly. Mostly, like, spaceships and stuff. And I would leave them all out lined up at night. And sometimes in the morning when I would come down, there was this strange phenomenon where there would be a new ship that had been built and added to the collection. They were always way better than mine. And I remember one in particular. It had, you know, this had a bridge, like a cockpit with all these little astronauts, and they each had a chair and a control panel, and it had a light feature, a light-up brick, and it had a transparent floor so that when you turned it on, the interior illuminated. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen. Where did it come from? Did it come from swishing around the pile? No. The pile cannot account for that ship, because the ship is more than the pile. Whatever made that ship is more than the ship. You can actually know a lot about the maker of that ship by looking at it. The colors match, so the maker can see. It's symmetrical. The maker can think geometrically. The maker gets basic circuitry. The maker can think proportionally because the astronauts are in proportion with the rest of the ship. You look at it and you're like, a person made this. And it wasn't me. And God knows it wasn't my sister. I'm building it up like it's a mystery. It was never a mystery. I'd come downstairs and I'd say, cool, Dad built a ship. There's no mystery at all. All that ship tells you is that I have a dad who is a kid at heart and has a background in engineering. That's all it tells you. And that's my point, is that if you really take a minute and look around at the fall leaves outside today, and you look in your heart, and if you really take a minute and take in what is around you, how can you not arrive at the conclusion that you have a dad too, who builds way cooler things than light-up spaceships, right? He makes us. From where I stand, that is the most rational conclusion, that there is a maker. That is the only thing that can account. And so here's my parting challenge, is don't believe in something false. Don't waste your energy or life believing in something that there's not a good case for. What is your worldview? What do you really believe constitute ultimate reality? And can that account for your life and for the things that you see? And if it can't, then it's time to hunt for a new one. There's only one worldview that can hold it all. It's God. So look around and ponder what it means and put your faith in something real. I wanted to save a minute or two here at the end to bring up my friend Harry. Harry's got a story. Harry went through this journey of pondering, reconsidering his worldview, and I wanted to invite him up here to say something to us. Come on up, Harry. Here, let me move these up a little bit. All right, so I already know your story, but I'll ask the questions anyway.
Sure.
So tell us about tell us a little bit about your starting place. Where were you before you were a Christian? Okay. What was your worldview?
Well, I grew up as a child in a nominally Christian home. You know, we went to church occasionally, so I had a very simplistic belief in God, but you know, the Bible was just a book of moral fables, good moral fables, but just fables themselves. And when I was about a teenager, for a number of reasons, I fell in love with science. And I just made that decision that You know, my trajectory, my life, I wanted to pursue a science education and wanted to make that a career. I eventually did do that. I have 2 degrees, PhD in biochemistry. And when I was in high school, I really delved into my science classes, and I became convinced that science explained away the need for God. Particularly as I studied biology and evolution, it provided, at the time, to me, a very satisfying explanation for how all of life, all the complexity of life that we have came to be. And so by that time, I became an atheist. As one author put much later on, I became an intellectually satisfied atheist.
Good. So at a certain point, something cast doubt on that worldview. Tell us about that.
I came down to Ohio State to pursue my education. And I remember sitting in one of my first biochemistry classes as an undergraduate. And the class was on the origin of life, how life came to be and how life reproduces at a cellular level. And the professor started talking about this molecule called DNA and how DNA is sort of the key to how life reproduces. And he described DNA as a biological computer code, as a biological library that houses all of the instructions, all of the information that's necessary for the building blocks of life. And I clearly remember sitting in that class, and I was sort of really struggling with this concept because I knew a little bit about computer code and computer programming, and I realized to have a computer code, you need a programmer. And I'm like, okay, a library houses books. Books need an author. So I started looking at this DNA and how it worked, and I realized, we need a biological programmer. We need a biological author to create this. And at the time, I'm realizing, that seems to be pointing to God. And I have to admit, I did not want to believe that. I really struggled with that. So I actually spent several months looking at other potential explanations for how DNA came to be and how it works. Some of the ones that you mentioned earlier when you were quoting Sean Carroll, the idea of evolution, random chance, and even just the basic laws of physics and chemistry. But as I delved in and looked at those, they were very inadequate, woefully inadequate, to explain how life came to be and how life reproduces. And so I remember this was probably the end of my sophomore year in college. I begrudgingly had to admit that the best explanation was that there is a God. So I was a very reluctant convert to theism, to a belief in a God. I didn't believe in Christianity, but I was like, okay, there is a God.
So the step for you went from there cannot be a God to there must be something like a God.
Right.
And then
that opened up a whole bunch of new questions that I never really ever considered before, or if I had, I had sort of stuffed them aside. First of all, who or what is this God? You know, is this God a personal being, or is he like Star Wars, you know, the Force? Is this God knowable? Can I or should I have a relationship with this God, or is he so impersonal or so remote that it's just impossible? And then probably the biggest question, and the one that sort of had been running in the background of my mind all along, was if there is a God, what happens to me after I die? Prior to becoming a believer in God, I just figured I'd be food for worms after I die. Now it's like, okay, if there is a God, does that change the equation? Is there life after death? And if so, does knowing this God somehow impact that? And the reality was, science couldn't answer really any of those questions for me. So that began a second journey of investigations where I studied the various world faiths. And probably about a year later led me to become a believer in Jesus. And I saw that there was a lot of rational evidence, both within the Bible and outside the Bible, to point to the truthfulness of Christianity and that Jesus is who he claimed to be. So that was 35 years ago.
Thanks, Harry. Mm-hmm. Good story. Let's hear it from Harry, everybody. Why don't we pray? Yeah. Thank you for the ways that you have revealed who you are to us, God. And thanks for the awesome place you've given us to live. And we just are grateful for that. We ask that you would help all of us to comprehend what you want us to see in you from what's been made around us. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.